the same known in the Americas as the Papal Bull. And we are going to have an introductory reading, which is actually a quote from a French translation of this particular sacred text. The translation is dated in the late 1800s, and chapter one of this script begins this way. And again, this is from Ancient Landmark Series. You can find it in Magazine Theosophy 16. You can also find it in the bound collection of articles on the various ancient landmarks of the Theosophical movement. But chapter one of the Papal Bull begins this way. This is the first book written of old, but the perception of it is hidden from him who looks with his eyes and who thinks with his brain. Marvelous is both its appearance and its recital of the times in which was completed the formation of all that is in the heavens and on the earth. The making symmetrical and the quadrangulation of its signs, the measure of its angles, their alignment, and the establishment of parallels on the heavens and on the earth at the four cardinal points. It then proceeds to narrate how everything was in latency and void was in the night. Only the creator, the former, the dominator, the feathered serpent, they who engender, they who give being, hovered over the water as a dawning light. They are enveloped in green and azure. That is why their name is Cucumatz, the feathered serpent. Of the greatest sages is their being. Then came his word with the dominator and the feathered serpent, and they consulted together and meditated. And while they consulted, it became day. And at the moment of the dawn, man manifested himself, while they, in the darkness and in the night, were holding counsel upon the production and growth of trees and creeping vines, of sentient beings and humanity, by him who is the heart of heavens, whose name is Hurakan. Lightning is the first sign of Hurakan, the second, the path of the lightning, the third is the thunderbolt, and these three are the heart of the heavens. Thus, of a truth, the creation took place and the earth was spoken into being. Earth, they cried, and instantly it took form. Like a mist or a cloud was its beginning. Then the mountains rose up out of the water. Only by a magical power could that be performed, which had been meditated upon as to the shadowing forth of the mountains and the valleys. And at the same time, the cypress and the pine appeared. Then was Cucumatz filled with joy, crying out, "Blessed be thy coming, O Horicon, and our work and our labor has accomplished its end." The earth then was covered with various forms of animal life, and the creator and former said to the animals, "Speak now our name." But the animals could not speak as a man. They said to their makers, "Our glory is not yet perfect, since ye cannot invoke us. Dens and food shall ye have, but as to your flesh, it shall be eaten. This is your destiny." So there we have, in a translation of the ancient language of the Mayans, an account of the beginning of manifestation and the root of theosophical truths. The underpinnings of the philosophy of theosophy are ancient, eternal, and impressed within each heart. As one is attracted to this search for universal truth, there is a gradual recognition of the many traces of theosophy across all ages, peoples, places, landmarks of the theosophical movement. The American Papa Vol is such a sacred trace. Blavatsky's mission included creating signposts for the search for these truths. The second object of the Theosophical Society is to study ancient and modern philosophies, religions, and sciences. The Declaration of ULT includes the fact that a true student, ever a seeker, belongs to no cult or sect, but to each and to all. In the popular collective mind of 2026, a new term has emerged. Sometimes it's spelled as omniest, and sometimes it's spelled as omnist, O-M-N-I-S-T. This is defined as one who does not claim any one religion or practice or belief, but who finds truth in them all. That term in the 21st century certainly echoes what was established in the 19th century. This talk on the Papa Vol is merely an introduction, an invitation for each of us to participate in an ongoing search for theosophy as expressed in all human endeavors to make meaning, to find meaning, to be meaningful. The fact that this ancient wisdom can be found among the early peoples of the Americas is most intriguing. H.P. Blavatsky traveled the Western Hemisphere extensively in the 1800s. Her pilgrimage offered her proofs of theosophy among the indigenous peoples of America, North, Central, and South. She and William Q. Judge informed the world that it would be in inclusive America that a new race would arise, the culmination of past forms and beingness, a new point on the spiral of ever-becoming of the Theosophical movement. Judge also traveled to Central America in the late 1800s, more possibly in Mexico and Panama than elsewhere. On the pages of Isis Unveiled and the Secret Doctrine, the wisdom of ancient America is discussed. The Mayans are evidence of the development from the Lemurian to the Atlantean to the Aryan great races. A student can also read a collation of derivative articles called Ancient Landmarks for additional insight. Today, we can read and ponder what was once an oral tradition and mythology rooted in prehistoric eras, recorded during the post-Columbian colonial era, and cherished even today among the Caché peoples of what we call Guatemala, one particular nation inside the Mayan overview. The Papa Vol is a recording of oral traditions surviving all the transitions from the Atlantean to the Aryan great races. While Spanish conquistadors worked to purge the world of the native religious philosophy and culture, there were some who chose to record the early oral traditions in European written languages. The genocide was not successful as a result. The true human spirit reigns supremely, no matter what the conditions. In 17th century Guatemala, priests of the Roman Catholic tradition wrote of the feathered serpent mentioned in the Papa Vol, using their European alphabet to express Caché, or the Mayan dialect. The initial efforts were accomplished by Francisco Ximenez. His work in Spanish was then translated into French by Abbé Brasseur de Bourbourg. It was the latter source that H.P. Blavatsky studied and used in her writings as she collected evidence of theosophy throughout the ages. Blavatsky stated in her writings that the Mayans were coeval with Plato. The oral traditions of the Mayans reached back thousands of years before them. In the 20th century, interestingly, beginning in 1975, yet another effort was made to clarify the Popol Vuh for modern scholars. American Alan J. Christensen worked with the Cachet peoples for decades to revive the Cachet language. He developed an English Cachet dictionary, its phonetic, with the help of Mayan shamans and elders. He then used that work to create a translation of the original sources of the Popol Vuh, hoping to get as close to the original message as possible. And all these sources are in print, online, or in hard copy, very affordably for study today. The Sacred Book of the Maya, a re-embodiment of an understanding of the beginnings of this period of manifestation, the role of man in nature, a history of the peoples of America and beyond, is now physically preserved. Popol means assembly of nobles, and so this sacred text is the book of the Holy Assembly of Nobles. Its name is like, very, very like, a book, a section of the Kabbalah. Its message was described as, quote, the word of God in pre-Columbian Middle America. In Christensen's work, the full meaning of the title is now translated with the help of Cachet elders. The translation is, quote, the record of human existence in the overshadowing world, and how man saw light and life. Very suggestive indeed. The text itself is divided into four parts: creation, mysteries, civilization, priesthood. This morning's talk will focus more on cosmogony, creation, and a search for the fundamentals of theosophy held within the Mayan mind. That's the focus, rather than on a full study of the entire text. Blavatsky states in Isis on page 2 of volume 1 that the scripture speaks of a far more spiritual race than early man. That early or initializing race could reason, speak, use unlimited sight, and know all things intuitively, immediately. Those early deific souls could then inform the later and less developed masses of souls in the ways of agriculture, technology, science, and theosophy. On page 549 in the first volume of Isis, Blavatsky says that the Popol Vuh records a cosmogony of consecutive attempts to create human forms for successful spiritual use. She points out that these teachings run a direct parallel to Kabbalistic accounts. Students of theosophy can compare the Popol Vuh to other teachings of the early rounds and races, manifesting from the absolute, the deific unknowable. Blavatsky stressed that the Mayan teachings can be readily aligned with those of the Phoenicians, the Babylonians, and the Egyptians. On page 552 of the first volume of Isis, she went so far as to say that the Toltecs descended from the house of Israel, that the days of Atlantis allowed for such a transmission of ancient wisdom from one hemisphere to another. And of course, for modern students, we're thinking that that cultural communication and transfer of information from the Eastern Hemisphere to Atlantis to the Western Hemisphere is a physical representation of the impress within the soul of each human. On the pages of the Secret Doctrine are found more guideposts to understand the Papal Bull. In Volume 1, on page 345, it is stated that the Mayans knew that early mindless man was created from mud or clay taken from underwater, symbolic of a creation process. This is a direct parallel to the Brahmanic renditions of the first man, the great Muni, constructed from water, air, and earth. The spirit of the divine moved on the chaos of the water and on the primordial or pre-Adamic earth, and evolutionary creation devolved from the most ethereal, the most spiritual, to the most concrete, the most physical manifestation. Throughout the Papal Bull, this process involves the use of the imagery or symbolism of numbers. You will find in your studies one spiritual source, and then the two, the duality of the sun and the moon as forces in the creation of nature and a man. The manifestation of a sevening is mentioned. Seven families, seven caves, seven cities, seven heroes escaping from a great deluge. Throughout the emergence of man as a self-conscious entity, there are successive efforts to create just the right forms to be used by self-conscious entities. Each failure was destroyed from the physical earth. Citing the Bourbourg manuscript in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine, page 96, Blavatsky identifies the Mayan account as the development of the third root race and transition into the early fourth. In the Papal Bull, four creative gods are sung and celebrated. These are united in the concept of a feathered serpent, reminiscent of the bird of life described in the pages of theosophical literature, like the voice. In the series Ancient Landmarks, a separate study of the divine in man, the feathered serpent, can be accomplished. In Cachet, the language of the Papal Bull, this is known as Kolka Khan or Gukumats. In the other Mesoamerican languages, Quetzalcoatl is the more common name. But one image, one symbol, universal. In the second volume of the ST, on page 181, Blavatsky explains the symbolism of the Mayan cosmological account. The third race, to the Mayans, was created of tzitta, a tree substance. It was then made of the narrow and the marrow of a reed, sibek. In their language, another meaning for this word, sibek, sibec, is egg, a most sacred symbol throughout theosophical literature, throughout the theosophical movement. We can also find on the pages of the Voice of Silence allusions to the Shagna plant being so rare in the coming of great ones. There are implications of initiations conducted in seven caves among the Mayan. Modern-day Christensen is convinced that the original Mayan texts are safe and preserved in certain caves known only to a select group of shamans. Blavatsky wrote of similar statements of tremendous sacred texts still being preserved, protected in crypts and caves and niches. Among the Mayan, the knowledge that the sun and moon have a metaphysical meaning in the development of the globe and humanity is rife with power. They mention a great fire or energy available to humans that can be symbolized as a great snake of creative power. The preservation and secrecy of this potentiality in the human state brings to mind Eastern teachings of Kundalini and a sacred force not to be taught or to be misused by the undeserving, ignorant, and self-centered. Such cultural transition transcends accounts of the great floods that ended the evils of the Atlanteans. The Hebrews knew these floods as Noah's lessons. The Chaldeans knew these floods as the lessons of Utnapishtim. The Mayans, the Quiché, knew these floods as Tlingithian lessons. Blavatsky brought these together in the second volume of the SD on page 222. Now, there are huge amounts of parallels and symbols in the Popol Vuh, far too many to cover this morning. But let's recap a few that are cosmological that will have a great resonance within our hearts and minds. In part one of the Popol Vuh, the Mayans taught of a reality beyond eye and brain, a source of the symmetry manifesting akin to the four cardinal points. Not a head doctrine, a heart doctrine. A void that becomes night and day. An earth that was spoken into being through sound or vibration emanating from ideation. A body of sages that could inform or enlighten humans, and that apes, the form of the apes, were a reminder of past failures in a process of creation. In part one, we find statements about the race of a giant population, a titan population, that were merely one stage of the development in the history of humans. The part one speaks of the wise who continue on behind the scenes, similar to what we read of the Nagas in the SD. Part one speaks of the egg-born being merely one stage of procreation. Again, a parallel to what Blavatsky brought forth from universal teachings. So many of these concepts are familiar to the student of theosophy. The absolute force coming into manifestation in gradual stages from spirit to matter. Perfected souls working akin to a guru parampara chain. Nature unaided, failing. In part two, the Mayans taught about trials of initiation. The male and female powers produced two sons, two manifestations of human awareness. These are in constant competition, akin to a ceremonial game that they played, a ball game or like a tennis game, which was meant to teach spirit in action through a physical form. What would be necessary among the wise to balance the karmic stress of cause and effect by spirit encountering physicality? What it would be like to reharmonize through strenuous efforts and a knowledge of the science of life. For this student of theosophy, here's the lesson of the duality within humans. Self-conscious use of mind, passions, imaginations, behaviors, affecting all the kingdoms of nature in a concerted effort or game of life. Spiritualized life produced with great intent and skill. We speak of the art and science of life. In part three, the Mayans taught creation of humans in an array following the achievement of this duality. Ixbaba was said to be the land of shadows. Ixbaba was to the east and appears very much to be a descriptor of Atlantis to the east of Mesoamerica. 10 princes showed how to control the lower astral senses, much as in the teachings of the Egyptians. There was a tree of knowledge mentioned in part three. There's the mention of an entity being dead for 3 days before arising. And golden yellow is the symbol used for the first solid race to come forth. For the student of theosophy, here's a recording of the history of the rounds and races, the fall of Atlantis, the loss of the third eye of spiritual vision, the diaspora of peoples after the flood, each people carrying an impressive knowledge as best they could recall and communicate. And among the indigenous, that early communication was oral tradition. In part four, the Mayans recorded the period of rise and fall of civilizations and dynasties, experiments in right living. The patriarchs had withdrawn. The seer had disappeared. The house of sacrifice is a symbol that is used, an expression of the rise of religions and city life. And that house of sacrifice for the Quiché was called Kabaha. It continued through the ages until finally undone in the age of the encounter, the post-Columbian experience of the Mayan. For the student of theosophy, the parallels of the Islamic Kaaba, a square, a cube, and the symbol of the lower quaternary of personal man, the triumph of passions and desires over the truth of spiritual spirit, the Tower of Babel, replacing spiritual soul communication, illusions of separateness and power and materialism arising among blind people, power, prestige, materialism, all calling for, all necessitating the use of a game of life as an initiation back into the light of spirit. The scope of the theosophical movement in our Manvantara. So the wisdom remains universal. The Quiché guarded the wisdom, and they still do so. Blavatsky shone a light on theosophy. It is for us to call it forth once more, to discover it, to rediscover it, to celebrate it whenever and wherever it is found, to preserve and protect it, to communicate it once again. And that's a snapshot view of the Popol Vuh, the American treasure of an ancient landmark. I'm sure that you arrived this morning with your own views of this treasured wisdom that we can find around the world. SL?
Aside from the rewards of studying it as an ancient landmark and historical study, as the idea comes forth in the talk and the presentation that there's a cyclic rise and fall of nations of thought. And it would seem, especially with the translation that was done in 1975, that there's a rise of this ancient theosophy in America becoming more prevalent now. And so, and certainly we see it with the influx of Eastern thought from India, from China, even Islamic thought, Kabbalistic thought. There all seems to be a, not just a melding of the races physically, but a blending of all these hidden esoteric traditions in the West at this time. We should be able to see more evidences of it.
We should be able to, and in the experience of our daily lives, we may observe in current events how theater, music, and dance can be used to teach lessons, to elicit inclusivity. We see many, many examples of how all of this can be a trigger for the upsurge in compassion, an upsurge in an appreciation of universal brotherhood that has nothing to do with the tad bit of 1% physical difference among us. But we need to be awake, aware, and discerning, critically aware of what is available to one and all, and where is there miscommunication and where is there pure communication. We can't passively accept anything that we experience or read. We can't passively accept what we're told. We have to literally use our heart and minds to judge for ourselves. Theosophy Hall, your hand went up first before Erica's.
So this talks about four, does this talk about four root races in the Popol Vuh? Was this written before our current age, the Dark Age, the Kali Yuga, or not written, but does the oral, how far back does, we don't know. Okay.
We don't know. The oral traditions precede any sense of written language, although the Mayans did have their own written language. We see it in glyphs. You can see it in architectural detail on their pyramids and their different structures. So this wisdom probably dates back to 18 million years ago, but we can't track it. We can only track the fact that in the late 1600s, there was a series of Spanish priests that worked on translating and publishing in that was late 1700s, late 1800s. It became the use of the French translation came forth. And then in the late 1900s, we have another translation into English. But how far back theosophy is, it's eternal. Erica, your hand is up.
Yeah. If anyone who's interested, I don't know if it specifically mentions the Popol Vuh, but I know in the Secret Doctrine that Blavatsky cited to a book that is called Sacred Mysteries of the Mayan and Quiché People. I can paste it here. One moment.
Thank you.
Yes, there we go. It goes really into depth, and it takes writings of the ancient Latin American cultures, like hieroglyphs, and it matches them to Egyptian hieroglyphs. And it goes into far more detail than that. I haven't read it in full. It might mention the Popol Vuh, I don't know. Probably not, because I think it. I don't know. But anyways, there's that if anyone's interested.
Thank you so much. And everybody can avail themselves of that reference by looking at the chat. Eric has kindly entered that. We live in very, very exciting times in terms of anthropology and archaeology, because around the world, it is now possible to view ruins, architectural details. There have been tremendous aerial photography done in which, buried within the jungles of South America, you can see what looks like runways that are aimed at Stonehenge. There are all sorts of amazing discoveries that go back to prehistoric times that Blavatsky hinted at and forecast. This is reality. All of these things are going to be unearthed as the times are right. And sure enough, here they come. Very, very exciting. Theosophy Hall.
Yes, go ahead.
The speaker mentioned this revision, not a revision, but a more clear presentation of the Popol Vuh having been written in 1975. And when she said this, she's very focused and she put an emphasis on 1975. Why would that be the case?
In the body of Theosophy, we are informed that there has been, since the 1400s, an effort in the last 25 years of every century. There is a spiritual effort to renew, reinvigorate the search for spiritual truths. And you can do a separate study of the late 1400s, say for the Renaissance, the 1500s, it was something else, and so on. In the 1700s, the American Revolution is said to be one expression of this. And what became amazing to this student in this search for this talk was that the early Spanish translation of the Popol Vuh was really being developed in the late 1600s, in that last quarter of the century. The French translation was really coming by the late 1700s. Blavatsky was using it after 1875, the French translation, and giving new scope and sequence, if you will, to the Popol Vuh. And then in this very mysterious late 1900s, we're very, very close to the 1900s, make no claims about what the manifestations were totally. But in the midst of all the New Age hubbub came this very quiet gentleman who was a dentist by trade, saved his money for as long as he could, and then his family gave him permission to use his personal wealth to become a student of linguistics and art and anthropology, because he wanted to figure out what the Cachet language was like and what the Popol Vuh really said. And what struck this student was that this was in each last quarter of the century. So these cycles of activity and rest appear to be recurring, and we can each do a separate study of that. Theosophy Hall and then SL.
No, actually, there's not another hand. We just forgot to take it down. Sorry. There's some chats too.
Okay, the other thing is clarification. didn't mean to say that this English translation back to the original cachet was the best text. I'm not Blavatsky. I don't pretend to have her overview. It's just that we now have an effort to go back to the origin, to drop any overlay that might have existed among priests of the Spanish and the French age. But certainly Blavatsky was very confident in the translation and the communication that Bourbourg wrote, and he was French. SL, your hand is up, and then we'll do some chats.
Aside from the doctrinal similarities in the researches, was there any conclusion found as to the nature of the discipline, the ethical path, the spiritual path of development that characterized the practical application of these teachings, either in the Popol Vuh or the general Mayan commentary, so we get any idea of what their heart doctrine was like practically.
For this study, I have to say that that's a limit to my studies in terms of ethical practices. Other than that ball game, where that rite and ritual that so many early scholars said, oh, it was just sports. No, there was imagery there that the masses could be shown a ball game in which there was tremendous focus, there was very active control in terms of strategy using physics of how to respond to anything coming to you and how to hit it back with great balance and hit a particular target. We've got pictures of Mr. Judge with archery equipment, which connotes the same exact thing. From much earlier studies of the Mayans in world history, when you look at the Mayan cultures in comparison to the Aztec cultures, the Mayan people were known to be incredibly peaceful, a very lofty degree of spirituality. Their pyramids, their temples, all pointed to how do you study the universe, the solar calendar, and put that into effect in your daily life in a very spiritualized form, as opposed to the Aztec peoples slightly north who were warfaring and were constantly belligerent. It runs a parallel if you study the peoples that lived along the Nile, where they developed a very peaceful, civilized, spiritual, intellectual life with agrarian and urban traditions, with a very peaceful river, as opposed to the people of the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, where the river raged uncontrollably with no symmetry, no control, and where the people remain very warring even until today. Different incarnations, different thrusts, but no, that would be a future research. Does anybody else know anything about the ethics of the cachet? SL?
Well, we were just thinking from what was said that those ball games for the masses served the same purpose as those Dionysian theatrical performances in ancient Athens. It was a way of teaching the masses the mysteries of life and how to apply them. And we were particularly struck by the fact of mention that how to actively respond, how to deal with life as we find it, with spiritual knowledge, was the purpose of the games, as said. And it reminds, well, isn't that truly the foundation of Western occultism as opposed to Eastern occultism, that the practical application of spiritual knowledge in the duties of everyday life, Judge says, is particularly a characteristic of of Western occultism, and we see it right in the foundations of the American tradition there.
Yes,
a
it is.
completely a different emphasis.
Different emphasis, but very, very practical, and very, very applied. Oh boy, we've got a few chats. I can't tell what order they came in, so we'll start at the beginning. The description of Quetzalcoatl aligns with the descriptions of the peacock angel of the Yasidi. The Yasidi have a tradition of a peacock angel falling from heaven from the snake constellation. It's also rumored that the black stone in the Kaaba in Mecca is that stone, that fallen one. A comet appears like a feathered angel to an ancient mind. Very interesting observation. And in the theosophical literature, you can read about learning to live as if you were astride the back of a sacred bird. So it's very, very interesting. And the use of the words Atlantis, Atlantic Ocean, Kabbalah, Kabbalah, Kahabah. Can these indeed be coincidences? The student doesn't think so. Then we have that Erica's reference to the archives with the connection between ancient Latin American beliefs and that of ancient India, Greece, Egypt, Chaldea. And the book itself is cited by Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine. There is another share from Duane. Later, also in 1975, in Terence McKenna, there's made a connection between the Mayan calendar and the I Ching, the I Ching, and predicted an event at the end of the Mayan calendar. Some thought it would be a comet again, though something else has happened. The end of the Mayan calendar really took up the popular mind for quite a while. And there was some emphasis that actually they ran out of space on the stone where they were recording this, and they really didn't mean to imply the end of the world. But that Mayan calendar is really in itself quite a symbol, in that it's circular, it's concentric, but it's also like a spiral. And that these very, very peaceful and astute folks in the Americas had done a great deal of astronomical study and had a sense of spiritual life coming to this planet from a different globe. And we can find all sorts of parallels with that. Then we've got LAS, a comment. Did the Mayans practice human sacrifices to the gods? Is human sacrifice mentioned in the Popol Vuh? There came a time among certain portions of the Mayan, probably very influenced by the Aztec, where human sacrifice, blood rituals were practiced. And in that fourth portion of the Popol Vuh, where they're doing more of a history of the rise and fall of civilizations and limits of behaviors and what is virtuous and what isn't, that you can find some trace of that. But among the Caché, even today, there may be a very humble degree of life of people living close to the land, close to the sea. But there is a tremendous sense of oneness and compassion. And even Christensen, when he was a graduate student traveling through Guatemala for the first time, trying to record the written language, he was walking around and he was given a nickname of something like Pale One with Spider Legs, because he was wearing shorts and he had skinny little pale legs. But one day when he was hiking back to where he was staying, he came across what appeared to be a humble little hut. with four elders out front sipping coffee, corn-based coffee. And they greeted him, and they asked, was he so-and-so Spider Legs, and what was his study really about? And the conversation started up because he did have a knowledge of cachet enough to speak. And he was invited to join them for a cup of coffee, which he did. Eventually stayed overnight in this hut. And it turned out that these four very humble, very peaceful, very unassuming individuals who could not read their own language but could speak it had a full knowledge of the Popovol and turned out to be shamans. And when he was able to take out his manuscript that he'd been working on and read in their language from his translation of what he'd found so far, there was a great ritualistic celebration. He was welcomed into that group and given far more access to literature than he'd previously had. But this was so striking because it appeared to be an accidental, coincidental meeting in which he absolutely met exactly the folks that he needed to do. And they did not affiliate themselves with human sacrifice at all. Anybody else? MDW.
One of the characteristics of the Mayan civilization were the pyramids. But if we look, Egypt had pyramids, and if we see that through modern discovery, they're finding pyramids all over the world.
Yes, they are.
So we would assume that this knowledge was, worldwide.
We have in this century tremendous evidence from archaeological digs, from aerial overviews, frankly, from satellite shots looking down below the ground. That's how they're finding some of these archaeological locations. What we have is physical evidence supporting Blavatsky's collection of information that she presented as Isis Unveiled and the Secret Doctrine. She was presenting information saying this will come to pass, things will be uncovered, evidences will be provided. And lo and behold, here it all comes. If only we keep our minds and heart open and we look into the depth of news reporting. What is the modern science? What is the modern philosophy? What can we find in the modern times? And how does that relate to the ancient? And isn't that the theosophical movement? Up to us to do the uncovering and the thinking and the communication. Well, thank you for coming this morning. Thank you so much for that reference. And please, please, Wednesday night will be a study in the key that is sure to be very, very vital. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thank you. That was wonderful.